Thank you, Aaron, Katie, for organizing this conference. So today I'll talk about the impact of alternative dark matter models on galaxies, and I'll specifically focus on the epoch of reionization. I'll say that I'm a galaxy formation person, so I'll come into this from the other side to others in this group. Let's see where we can get here. So I don't need to show this picture, but I usually do. This is cosmological structure formation. Basically, what I am trying to do in my research is just taking initial conditions. This doesn't work. Taking initial conditions from the CMB, and then you evolve it under gravity, which is mainly dark matter dominated, but then also hydrodynamics, radiation fields, magnetic fields, star formation, and black hole feedback. And so this part is called gastrophysics, and that's what I'll mainly focus on during my research. Okay? So the idea is to take initial conditions, try to get something like what our universe looks like. And you have to go from density contrast of 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the 5. So it's in a highly nonlinear system. So that's why you go to simulations in order to do this properly. Okay? Since this is a dark matter workshop, I'll start with the cold dark matter scenario. And we know that the cold dark matter has been really successful in explaining a lot of different things. One of the first successes was explaining the large-scale structure of the universe, basically. This blue dots are the CFA, 2DFGR simulations. Observations, and these red points are these millennium simulations, and in this large volume, they showed for the first time that if you use the Landa CDM model, you kind of get the large-scale structure correct. Okay, and since this has been so successful, almost all simulations that do galaxy formation nowadays use the cold dark matter paradigm as the background. So in this paradigm, the dark matter does nothing except just providing gravity for the structures to form. Okay? And you can see that if you add baryonic physics on top of dark matter, you can produce realistic-looking galaxies. And this is a snapshot from the illustrious simulations. Okay? Obviously, there are problems. If you go and look really carefully, there are problems with the cold dark matter scenario. One such problem, and most of these problems, I should say, exist on small scales. On large scales, the CDM does very well, but on small scales, there are some problems. One of these problems is the missing satellites problem. So this on the left is a simulation of a Milky Way kind of a halo, dark matter-only simulation. And these, you can see so many bright dots. All these are satellites of this kind of a big Milky Way galaxy in the center. But if you actually go and look at the Milky Way itself, you'll see very few satellites. So there is no one-to-one correspondence between what dark matter tells you, dark matter-only simulations tell you, and what you see in the real universe. So this was called the missing satellites problem. Where did all these satellites go? So that was the problem with the CDM. The other two main problems on small scales with cold dark matter is the too-big-to-fail problem and the cusp core problem. So the too-big-to-fail problem says that you can have galaxies. So these pink magenta or pink lines are rotation curves from simulations, and these black dots are classical Milky Way satellites. And these have very high rotation curves of about greater than 30 kilometers per second. And you cannot have reionization, for example, suppressing star formation in these massive halos. The point is these halos are massive enough that they should be forming stars, yet you do not see them when you go to the Milky Way. So that's why it's called the too-big-to-fail problem. On the right is the cusp core problem. We are showing you the cusp core problem. So if you take a normal NFW profile and you plot a rotation curve, it should look something like this. So that's the black dashed line here. But actually, if you look at the nearby satellites, DDO, whatever these things are, and you actually plot the rotation curve, then the core profile fits the rotation curve better. So the dark matter is cored, means the density profile is almost constant in the interiors of dark matter halos, rather than being cuspy. So that's the cusp core problem, okay? So that's where these alternative dark matter models come in. So basically, these alternative dark matter models, like ETHOS models that are produced here, these are basically self-interacting dark matter models. They kind of suppress structure formation on small scales. So what you can get is that you can get rid of, if you suppress structure formation on small scales, you can get rid of many of these satellites because they do not form. And so you can get back what the Milky Way distribution. So that you solve the two missing satellites problems that way. The other thing they do is like the density profile in the centers of these halos due to this scattering of dark matter becomes more cored rather than cuspy. So you solve the cusp core problem and the too big to fail problem as well using these kinds of, alternative dark matter models. So here, for example, there's this rotation velocity as a function of radius, and these are different alternative dark matter models. The gray line is the CDM model, and they have tuned this CDM model such that it goes through most of the Milky Way satellite rotation curves. Okay, so at low redshift, the suppression of structure formation and small scales helps you ease the tension between what you see for Milky Way satellites and what simulations predict, for example. So that's why alternative dark matter models are invoked at low redshift. Okay. But the problem is you can also do this using baryonic physics. Okay. So here is a paper, I think, from Andrea Macchio's group, but I took this from this review paper by Bullock and Boyle and Colchin. So what they did is they did a bunch of simulations from low mass to high mass, and they put in all the baryonic physics they can think of. And what happened if you put in this extremely strong supernova feedback, which was necessary to regulate star formation, was that you started creating cores in a certain mass range of halos. Okay, so here it is cuspy. In the very low mass, the dark matter is still cuspy. Very high mass, the dark matter is still cuspy. But if you go in the intermediate mass range where most of the Milky Way satellites sit, then the dark matter becomes cored because you have these supernova explosions going off, which blows out a lot of the gas, and it changes the potential on a very small time scale, such that the dark matter goes from cuspy to cored. And so you can also have baryonic physics solving the problem, and these two are kind of degenerate. So you can either solve this problem using alternative dark matter or just baryonic physics. Okay. So the question is, can we go to higher and higher redshifts where maybe we can get a cleaner signal, right? Because you don't have so much nonlinear structure forming at higher redshifts, so maybe the signal is cleaner. But obviously, it's much harder to measure things at higher redshifts, right? Even simple stuff like the UV luminosity function until about a year or two ago was extremely difficult to measure. So here is an example of the UV luminosity function at redshift 6 from just using HST. Okay, so until here, up to minus 16 or so, you're just looking at the galaxies yourself. I mean, there is no lensing involved. Okay, but below this, so this is low mass, that is high mass. This is magnitude units. Anyway, but below this, you have to rely on gravitational lensing, okay? These three points, the green, the red, the yellow, are all different HST field, lensing fields, and they all three give you very different answers. And the blue shaded region are the error bars on this lensing model. So CDM, also alternative dark matter, is supposed to suppress structure, especially on these small scales. And on those small scales, it's really difficult to say what is going on using just the Hubble observations. Okay, but of course, we are no longer reliant just on Hubble. We have JWST, which came online and has been revolutionizing the hierarchy of science for about a year or so now. So I don't need to explain too much, but JWST observes in the infrared, so that's rest frame optical, maybe even UE for these high redshift galaxies. So you get a much better picture. So this is the resolution for Spitzer compared to JWST in the IR, and you can see how much better it is. And you also have other techniques which are coming online that has been discussed in this conference workshop in the past 2 days, like 21 centimeter and nebular line intensity mapping, and even Lyman alpha forest. So all these are high redshift observations which are just getting better. So maybe we can use these high redshift observations to say something about dark matter physics as well, okay? So this is just one example of what JWST is doing. On the left, so previously here, I showed you the UV luminosity function at redshift 6, and you know, it was a mess. JWST came along, and within a year, there are estimates for the UV luminosity function at redshift 12 now, okay? I mean, most of this are photometric, so you should not trust it, but you know, you will get spectroscopy soon as well. And so this is a estimate of the luminosity function at redshift 12. You have one at redshift 14 as well. So you know, these are very impressive plots. All I'm trying to say is that JWSTs will help us quite a bit at this high redshift regime, okay? So that's where I'm not an observer, I'm a theorist, so I'm trying to model these high redshift galaxies. So we conducted these kinds of large-scale radiation hydrodynamic simulations called THESON, where the background is the density field and the temperature field going from redshift 16 to 5.5, so basically the reionization epoch. And you can see how around these young stars, around young galaxies, it emits some amount of radiation, heats up the gas around these galaxies, and these ionized bubbles get bigger and bigger, and they merge, and eventually the whole universe reionizes. Okay, so that's the large scale picture of what is going on in these simulations. But you can zoom in. You can zoom in and in, and then you can actually make resolved images of the galaxies that are causing this reionization process itself. So this is basically a galaxy formation plus a reionization simulation all in one. And so we are trying to use these kinds of simulations to try to see what alternative dark matter can tell us. I'll go skip over this. The thing I'm trying to say is that, we not only get the accurate reionization history of the universe as seen by observations, but we also get the right galaxy properties. It is important because not all simulation models get this right. So if you want to do dark matter physics, you have to pin down baryonic physics. If your baryonic physics is wrong, you won't get get constraints on dark matter physics. So that's why I'm showing these plots. So we are showing these plots to say that, okay, we not only get the correct reionization history, but we also get the right, I wouldn't say the baryonic physics is exactly right, but the right stellar masses in the galaxies that we put in, okay? So in these simulations, in addition to CDM, we also did one additional simulation of self-interacting dark matter, or strong dark acoustic oscillations model that's shown in the red. So that's the linear matter power spectrum. And you have this suppression on these small scales. So the way we include this is we do not really, the only difference between these simulations is in the initial conditions. So what we do is we take, for CDM, we create initial conditions from the black line, whereas for the SDAO, we create initial conditions from this oscillating line. That's the only thing. The rest of the physics remains the same.
So you don't expect the sub-interactions to matter on cluster galaxies? Like, that was kind of the point in the very beginning, right, to solve these.
Yeah, so it can either be, yes, so it can either, just using initial conditions might be enough. You might get the whole picture, or you might need to do full SIDM. But at high redshift, it seems that it's not that important. Just changing the matter power spectrum is good enough. So that's why we did that. Yeah. And then we tried to see if we see some difference, basically, in the observables. So what JWST will see, and can you actually differentiate between these models? So this is basically the star formation rate density as a function of redshift. Forget the red line for now. The blue line is the CDM, and the purple line is the SDAO model. And you can see there's some difference in the star formation rates. So that's encouraging. The difference is only at early times. If you go to very early redshifts, like redshifts below 10 or so, about 10 or so, then you see a difference. By the time you reach redshift 6 or so, then there is no difference between the CDM and SDAO models. The star formation kind of catches up. Okay. We also tried to see if we can use like 21 centimeter observations or line intensity, cross-correlating 21 centimeter with line intensity mapping to get some idea about what this alternative dark matter models can do. There is some difference, but as you can see, the baryonic physics, again, there is so much discrepancy in the baryonic physics. So this is a model where only large galaxies dominate reionization, whereas the blue is only small galaxies dominate reionization, and the brown is the alternative dark matter. There is a difference between them, but then we don't know so enough about baryonic physics to say too much about what alternative dark. You can always choose an escape fraction such that you get the brown line. That's my point, right? So there is no, the discrepancy is a lot. So you cannot say too much about what dark matter is doing. And you can also look at the UV luminosity functions that I showed before. Now at very different redshifts, the solid lines, sorry, okay, so the dashed lines are CDM and the dotted lines are SDAO. There is some suppression in these low mass galaxies, that's what you expect. But I didn't tell you what the solid line is until now. That is just a higher resolution simulation. So resolution changes your predictions for these low mass galaxies much more than the underlying dark matter model itself, right? So it's okay, but you need to go to much higher resolutions in order to say anything about what dark matter is doing. So that's what we did. So we said, okay, we cannot say much about using these large volume simulations. They're good to do other kinds of science, but if you want to do this dark matter science, then you need to go to higher resolution simulations. So that's what we did. We just focused on smaller volumes, much, much smaller volumes, maybe a factor of 100 or even lower small volumes, but much higher resolutions so that you can actually resolve all these galaxies that you want.
So can I ask you a quick question? Are you doing an N-body plus hydro?
Plus radiation, yeah.
Transfer?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
All of this together?
Yes, yes. So I'll show you where we went. So the simulations I was showing you before were the simulated volume of about 10 to the 6 Komaing megaparsec cubed. These were the simulations. But now we went down to around 100 Komaing megaparsec cube volumes, but much higher resolution. So the y-axis is the force resolution. So you go to much higher mass and for spatial resolution so that you can actually resolve the galaxies which are important, which are affected by these dark matter models. Okay? So these are the high resolution simulations that I'll talk about now. Okay, so here again. Okay. Here again, we also did not just CDM or SDAO, but we also included like fuzzy dark matter and warm dark matter simulations. Now, again, here we are not solving the Schrodinger Poisson equation or anything. We are just, the only way we include it is we change the initial conditions. So the matter power spectrum changes, linear matter power spectrum changes, your initial conditions changes, the rest remains the same, and then we see how these different models behave. Okay, so this is how it looks like. So that's CDM, this is fuzzy dark matter, warm dark matter, and SDAO. And you can see a lot more structure, small scale structure in the CDM, whereas these things are wiped out when you go to these models which suppress a structure formation on small scales. Okay, so how does this look like? So now, We know that we can resolve the galaxies that are affected most by this suppression of structure. And so we looked at the star formation rate density and the mass-weighted H1, so the reionization history. It doesn't matter too much. So forget about the bottom plot, but the top plot is more important. What you can see here is the star formation history for a normal CDM model versus a star formation history if you assume a uniform UVB background. So the other thing which is important that I have to tell you is that because it's the reionization epoch, the galaxies are being reionized. And the galaxies which are susceptible to suppression of structure susceptible to alternative dark matter models are also the galaxies which are susceptible to photoheating and suppression of star formation due to reionization. So if you want to understand and predict some properties of dark matter in this epoch, you need to do reionization properly, otherwise you won't get it right. Okay? So that's what is shown here. So if you just assume a uniform UV background, which almost every other simulation of galaxy formation does, then you drastically suppress star formation when you turn on this spatially uniform background. And that will suppress star formation in these low mass galaxies, which is not what you want. Okay? But if you actually do full radiative transfer simulations, then you get a much better picture of what is going on in these small halos. Okay. So you can see that here in the UV luminosity functions as well. Now the luminosity is going this way instead of the other way. Sorry about that. But each to their own. So you can see here that at redshift, let's say 8 or 6, so the orange line is the full radiative transfer simulation, and the blue line is if you just assume a constant UV background. And you do get suppression on small scales, like what you expect from dark matter, alternative dark matter models. But you can also get this suppression from just assuming a different radiation field. So that's why I'm trying to make this point really important that you need, if you want to use these galaxies, you need to model radiation properly. And so since we talked about POP3 stars, it's also important for, if you want to understand where POP3 stars are formed or how many POP3 stars are formed or what is the latest time you can form a POP3 star. So the point here is that if you have a uniform UV background, then what that does is that because it's spatially uniform, it ionizes and photoheats all the low mass galaxies in your volume. And it stops stars from forming immediately after you turn on. And so you no longer have stars forming in these low mass, low metallicity environments. So you stop POP3 star formation immediately. Whereas if you have this radiation background which permeates through and takes some time to get to these low density voids, then you can have these low mass galaxies keep forming stars all the way down to very low redshifts. Okay? This is a very, 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 you can talk to me about this POP3 model. It's not that sophisticated. So we can discuss this later. But the point is that it is important for this star formation and metallicity as well. Okay, so now let's look at the what alternative dark matter models do. So the first one we are showing, first plot we show is just the halo mass function, which we expect. So you have CDM, SDAO, warm dark matter, fuzzy dark matter. And as you expect, below a certain mass scale, you have suppression in structure. So that's clearly seen at redshift 6, 8, and 10. That's not unexpected at all, because this is just the halo mass function. But you can also look at other things like the star formation rate density. And here you can see that CDM is quite high at early times, but at late times, these much higher star formation at early times, but at late times, these alternative dark matter models catch up to the CDM star formation history. Okay, and that also leads to, I won't talk about reionization here. So the main plot is this one here, which just shows that even though you have suppression at early times, at late times, they're kind of similar. Okay. So you have a lot of gas just hanging around. I think what's happening is you have a lot of gas hanging around. As soon as you start forming galaxies at late times, they have a lot of gas in them, which just starts forming stars. That's what's happening.
You have the same amount of gas no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I'll show the gas fractions as well. So where is this suppression in star formation coming from? So if you look, what we have done is we have binned the halos in our galaxy in three different bins: high mass bin, medium mass bin, and really low mass bin. And this is the star formation rate divided by the star formation rate as you get from just the cold dark matter simulation at redshift 5.5. Okay, you can see at very early times, almost all the star formation is suppressed in the alternative dark matter models. The colorful anything non-blue is alternative dark matter, so blue is CDM. But at late times, in high mass galaxies, the star formation rate is very similar between all these models. But if you go to very low mass galaxies, 7.5 to 8.5, then at early times, there is a suppression. But at late times, you just boost the star formation by more than an order of magnitude. This is because you have this so much gas just hanging around, which then starts forming stars at redshift 6 or so. So you suppress star formation at early redshifts, but then it just catches up by the time you reach redshift 6 or so.
Sorry, what are the dashed and solid?
Just focus on the solid. We can talk about the dashed in the discussion section, okay? I won't talk about this, but this is just showing that you have much higher gas fractions. So you have a much higher specific star formation rate and alternative dark matter. So that's the reason why you have very high star. Okay. And then finally, the most important point is the UV luminosity function, of course. So at redshift 10, 8, and 6, again, focus on the solid lines. At redshift 10, you can see the CDM and the alternative dark matter models differ by quite a bit, more than one dex. So it's a good signal, which we can actually detect with JWST. So this is the JWST limit, and the purple lines are the JWST plus lensing limits. So there is some hope of detecting this at some point, okay? At redshift 10, the distinction is quite clear. By the time you reach 8 or 6, then it becomes a bit more complicated to figure out if you actually see the signal or not. But if you go to earlier and earlier redshifts, then you can there is a possibility that you can actually detect some imprints of alternative dark matter models using JWST plus lensing. Okay, so I'll conclude here. So alternative dark matter models suppress small scale power below the half power scale, which can be seen in the stellar mass and the UV luminosity functions. And JWST plus lensing is a promising avenue to detect signatures of alternative dark matter. Of course, there are complexities in this modeling of galaxies. One of the most important complexities is reionization. If you use normal, spatially uniform UV background models, then the signal is not what you get. You actually suppress these low mass galaxies, star formation in these low mass galaxies, which is not what you want. Okay, they actually keep forming stars, and there are nonlinear effects, as you said. So alternative, you would assume naively that they just suppress star formation in halos, but that's not true. They do suppress star formation at early redshifts, but at late redshifts, they kind of catch up at certain point, which is very different to just baryonic physics, just feedback. If it is feedback, it will be suppressing the star formation in these halos through all kinds of redshifts, right? But baryonic physics, dark matter physics seems to do something which is orthogonal, and it might be one way of disentangling dark matter physics from baryonic physics. So for future work, as I mainly concentrate on galaxy formation, my goal is to pin down baryonic physics much better and put more constraints on baryonic physics such that any differences that you see using alternative dark matter models is due to dark matter rather than the underlying assumptions. Okay, so thank you.
Can you show the neutral fraction plot you have on the slides earlier?
Neutral fraction, okay.
Yeah, top one.
Yep.
So there, the later star formation is manifested in the curves being higher than the Wood curve for the Altium models. Is that correct?
So yeah, so star formation starts early in CDM, so you have much lower neutral fractions at early redshifts.
Okay.
Okay. But then what happens is that, especially in fuzzy dark matter, the suppression of power is, it catches up so fast that it goes beyond and reionizes a bit faster. You get much faster reionization histories because you have this boost in star formation at late times.
And can you just remind me, because I don't know off the top of my head, 1 giga-year is said of
5.6, let's say.
Okay, you have an
Oh, oh yeah, 5.5, there you go, 5.26.
Is this variation extreme enough that we can see this just in...
No. No. I mean, the observational constraints are like really bad. I can,
yeah, they are now.
Like, you know, so what can you distinguish from that? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
The other question I had is, what does it do to the morphology of, like you said, the morphology of reionization affects these predictions, but also these predictions should affect the morphology of reionization in some way.
It couples to each other. Yes, exactly. So so the reionization topology is important because if you have a small galaxy near a big ionizing source, that'll be ionized and you won't really form anything there. But if you're void-like environment, then it can keep forming stars for much later times, and then you will see the effect much better. Yeah, that's the point I'm trying to make. So if you use a spatially uniform UV background, like what almost every other simulation does, then that's a problem, especially if you want to do science in this epoch. If you do want to do science at redshift zero, go ahead and use it, but yeah. Yeah.
Have you looked at the clustering at all?
No.
Okay. I was wondering the plot showing the luminosity functions.
Yes.
Whether at low redshift, you can still pick up different clustering patterns.
At low redshift?
Well, at lower redshift. You know.
No, that's a good point. We haven't done that. We stopped the simulations at 5.5 because they are expensive. We don't go down all the way to redshift zero. But yeah, we can. Yeah, we haven't done any clustering at lower redshift.
Because I'm guessing things are, you know, the bias.
Right.
From one. Others.
Right. Yeah, you can do something similar with intensity mapping, which will also give you something similar where the that'll tell you like how many low. So what that gives you is both a handle on star formation in halos and a handle on reionization history. So that can tell you how much of the star formation is in low mass galaxies versus high mass a bit. So that's one way of doing it as well, but yeah.
Can you go back to where you were showing the star, so you had a population 3 star.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah.
So what's going on that gives you such a big difference between the top and the all the curves are different.
So for POP3, okay, so I have to say, this is a very simple model. We don't have POP3 star formation in our models. What we did is if your star is below a certain metallicity, we say it's POP3-like. So what we did was, so you need for these low metallicity stars to form in your simulation, you need to have pristine gas, which is not affected by anything else, which means they need to be far away from nearby halos.
And are you worrying about like chemistry?
Yeah, we have chemistry and cooling in here. We do. But we don't have like POP3 star formation and stuff like that. So what this plot is showing is that if you can have galaxies which are small and metal poor, keep forming stars if you have a realistic reionization topology. And so that's why you'll still have these metal poor stars forming all the way down to redshift 6. Let's forget POP3 name for now. Just call it metal poor. Yeah, but if you have UV background, then what does that, because it's spatially uniform, it just ionizes everything, it doesn't care. And then only the galaxies which are massive enough to host, to keep the gas even after reionization will form stars, and they're already metal enriched.
You got this massive burst.
Yeah, so you'll never form metal poor stars beyond the redshift, that is where you put in the UV background. It might not seem that important to people who are not familiar with this, but the reason I'm pointing it out is almost all simulations use this model instead of that.
So did you see any significant differences between the different dark matter models? Because since you're only changing the color spectrum, I mean, depending on the parameters you choose, I guess they really just mostly all have a cutoff.
No, I think.
Different shape.
I don't know if you can distinguish individual models. You can say there is suppression on small scales. But beyond that, like what kind of a model it is, maybe you need better observables. The only thing we are looking at is like the UV luminosity function, which is the most accessible with JWST. And all you can say is there is some suppression. Beyond that, saying which it's warm dark matter, fuzzy dark matter, maybe there are other observations which can use. Maybe you can tell me which observations I should look at. I don't know.
Because I guess since you ran different runs, maybe some specific difference or something.
The most effect is due to the suppression on small scales, and that's it, right? We don't have like the exact physics of the dark matter going on in this. We don't have self-interactions, and we don't have like fuzzy dark matter, right? So it's just so we won't be able to predict that with these kinds of simulations.
In the dark matter literature, there's this whole problem of battery ionization.
Yes.
Do your simulations inform that? And
yes. I don't know about that problem.
There's criticism of the dynamo about warm dark matter.
Right.
Because they depend on the temperature of the AGM.
Right.
The problem is that usually for these bounds, the temperature of the AGM is assumed to be constant. But
right.
It's patchy instead because of
yes.
The effect that you're talking about.
Yes.
And that's not accounted for in most of these dynamo alpha bounds
yeah.
The assignment.
Right, right.
The ones that you're
right. They should. I don't know if they can solve it, but they will definitely inform them. We haven't looked at it. I'm sure Kerr has looked at it at some point. He's not here. But maybe. Yeah. But he has looked at it a bit. He can explain it a bit better. Maybe his models do these change the temperature, although I'm not sure. But yeah, these simulations can definitely inform whatever you want to do. We haven't looked at it, but. All the data is public, by the way, so we can definitely do it if you want to. Yeah.
You probably discussed this, and I just didn't catch it. But how does the catching up and overshooting happen? Like, so the suppression, and then you get more star formation.
Yeah.
What's happening there?
Yeah. So we tried to figure out what is happening there. So these are the plots trying to figure out what is happening. So the top plot is the specific star formation rate as a halo mass. Medium is the depletion times in these halos. And the bottom is the gas fractions. So, you know, the gas fractions, what seems to happen is that you have much higher gas fractions in these alternative dark matter models in these low mass halos compared to just CDM. Which then decreases your depletion times and increases your specific star formation rates. So we think what's happening is that there is suppression of structure, but that there's just gas sitting around with not doing much. Then once you form these structures at lower and lower redshifts, there's all this gas which just goes in and starts forming stars. That's what we think is happening. And that's what these plots kind of tell you, but we cannot really be sure.
So, if I recall correctly, Farhad told us, like, gave a talk here a while back, saying that it's sort of, at least in the context she was talking about, was these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, that it's sort of dangerous to draw conclusions about dark matter based on those simulations, because what you're doing with the dark matter is pretty degenerate with the subgrid star formation
model.
Is that something that potentially comes into play here as well?
Yeah. So the best we can do is to say, okay, we have a star formation model which works, which gives you the right properties of most of the galaxies that you see. And if you assume that that star formation model is accurate enough, then you can say something about the dark matter model. So that's why I put it as one of the future works, trying to figure out how much can you better understand baryonic physics so that you can understand dark matter physics. So all these, so the reason we kind of trust this is because if you look at the luminosity functions, in the range where the simulations make predictions and there are observations, we do quite well. So we have the same star formation model down here as well. It can be doing something very different at low scales that might cause some problems, but you know, that's why we are kind of, so you have to trust something, right? So we trust the model because it's doing something good on the larger scales, but that's the whole point.
Yeah.